Well, welcome back to another edition of Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk. I'm Luann Crane, and our host is psychologist and best-selling author Dr. James Dobson.
And I'm Ryan Dobson. And Luann, I know every parent listening knows that nothing changes your life like having a child.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember when Lincoln was born. I was so afraid. I thought I might break him.
I felt that way too, Ryan, and I think most moms listening would admit that they felt a little bit unsure when they first started out on that parenting journey. Well, last time, we brought listeners some very practical advice for those baby years with the help of Dr. Meg Meeker, and we have more in store for today.
I can't wait. Mm-hmm. Dr. Meeker has been a pediatrician for 25 years. She's the author of a number of different books, including Strong Fathers, Strong Daughters. That's one of my dad's favorites.
Mm-hmm.
And The 10 Habits of Happy Mothers. Listeners should also keep their eyes out for her latest releasing next spring about moms and sons.
Yes, that's the one I'm waiting for, Ryan.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Meeker is in private practice with her husband, Walt, and together they have four children.
Now, if parents listening today didn't hear the first half of our conversation with Dr. Meeker, they can always get caught up at drjamesdobson.org, on our podcast, or via our Family Talk app.
And it's important that you do, because we covered key issues like breastfeeding and sleep training.
Mm.
This is what we call around here nuts and bolts advice. Now, at the very end of the last program, we touched briefly on the whole topic of sudden infant death syndrome, but we didn't have time to do it justice, so we'll be fleshing out that thought a little bit more here as we start today.
I know that's something every parent is concerned mm-hmm. about with newborns. So let's see what Dr. Meeker has to say about it. Here now is our host, Dr. James Dobson, on this Family Talk broadcast.
Well, that program last time was fascinating mm-hmm. to me because we moved from one issue to another that I kind of hypothesized a mother being in your office and the kind of questions she's likely to ask if she has young children. And the two or three that we talked about were among them. And now let's talk about SIDS.
Sure, sure.
Give us kind of an overview again of what it is and what its implications are and what parents can do about it.
What parents can do, absolutely. Well, fortunately, we know more about SIDS, and yet we still don't know enough about SIDS. Mm-hmm. We don't really know what causes sudden infant death syndrome. And it really is every parent's nightmare, and I don't know if I've known a parent who's come in my office who hasn't feared it at one time or another.
Because some people even call it crib death.
Yes.
That tells
yes.
you how tragic it is.
Yeah, it's very, very tragic, and it's devastating. Fortunately for parents, it is quite rare. And I don't have numbers off the top of my head, but it really is pretty rare. The peak time that SIDS occurs is between 0 and 9 months. Some people take it 0 to 12 months. So you can feel pretty secure after your child hits that 9 to 12 month mark that you're in the clear and that the baby is really pretty safe and is not going to get SIDS. Some of the things that I advise parents, and I know that sleep patterns are very controversial. Some people feel strongly that, and I know there are physicians out there who feel strongly that babies from birth on should be sleeping with parents in parents' bed for bonding purposes. There are other physicians who say, no, children should never do that because it's dangerous. I err with the latter camp because in my practice, I've seen children suffocate from getting caught between the bed and the wall. So I give parents several tips for avoiding suffocation or SIDS because I know they're frightened. And the first is to make sure baby is on a firm mattress. And all cribs now come with very firm mattresses. If you want your baby to sleep in your room or near you, I recommend putting the crib right up next to the bed so that it's just the baby's mattress is on the same level as your mattress so the baby can sleep next to you but be on his or her mattress. It's also important that babies not sleep on their tummies, like I used to put my kids on their mm-hmm. tummy all the time. Intuitively, it seems that that would be safer, but it
sure
isn't.
Looks more comfortable.
Looks more comfortable. but we're not to put babies on their tummies, so I encourage parents to put kids on their back or their sides. One of the problems with putting kids on their back only or on one side only is that you can get problems with the head not shaping well as it grows. So you can get flattening on one side of the head. So I think it's important to move children from one side to the other. So always keep your baby on the side or on the back.
Meg, let me just ask you, though, if they're on their back, I remember being told that there was danger of choking. Is that not
regurgitating?
Correct. Yep. Yeah, is that not a consideration?
Well, you know, it is a concern, and I encourage parents not to put babies to bed on a full stomach. You may want to feed them and then rock them for half an hour, allow, the feed to just digest a little bit, mm-hmm. move a little farther down into the GI tract. But the research shows that babies are safer on their sides and their backs rather than their tummies. The other important thing to do when putting your child to sleep is to make sure that there aren't any pillows, loose clothing, anything that could suffocate a child. Because until a child is about 3 to 4 months of age, they don't have real good head control. So they could be suffocating and not be able to lift their head up off the crib to be able to get away from whatever is suffocating them.
Is that why doctors recommend not putting a blanket in with kids?
Yes. Yes, okay. Exactly. Not mm-hmm. putting a blanket. And even baby bumper, crib bumpers, those cute baby bumpers that we put on our cribs, Luann, when our kids were little.
Yes, I'm picturing one.
Well, your kids are older, so it's okay.
Okay.
So, but the recommendation is to keep them even, you know, just away from crib bumpers, stuffed animals, everything.
Is there any symptom or anything that would tip off a parent that your baby is at risk, or does it always come out of the blue?
You know, I wish we had a warning sign, and unfortunately we don't. So, no, there really is no way we can know which children are at risk for SIDS and who aren't.
I wonder how many parents have lain there in the middle of the night listening to the breathing, and if there is a four-second pause, they're awake and on alert.
Doctor, my son is 15. I think I still do.
I still do.
I still look for the chest going up and down when he's sleeping.
That's parenting. But, you know, one of my mottos to parents is never parent from fear. You know, you can either parent out of fear or faith. God has designated your child's life and the time of his birth and the time of his death. So that's really in his hands. So don't worry. I encourage parents really not to worry. I know it's hard for all parents not to, but again, it really is very rare. And if you take those precautions, that's very important.
You know, when I was at Children's Hospital, they told us that there are three disorders or diseases that you can't afford to wait on. Three things that you jump on, that you do something about as quickly as you can, maybe even with emergency help. And they are meningitis, appendicitis, and croup.
Yes.
Would you have a different list than that?
I would have added one more, and that was epiglottitis. And epiglottitis is an infection caused by Haemophilus influenza, where the epiglottis is a little piece of cartilage in the way back of the throat that if it got infected would swell and shut the airway off. And in my day, in the 1980s, when I was doing my training, that was every resident's nightmare, was a child would come in with that because you couldn't get a tube in quickly enough often. Fortunately, because of the Hib vaccine, epiglottitis is rarely seen anymore because of that vaccination that came about. So I'm very grateful for that vaccine because that's a life-threatening thing. But you're absolutely right. Meningitis, appendicitis, and croup are nothing to sneeze at. Very important you get help.
What do you do about croup? It also comes out of nowhere.
It comes out of nowhere. Yeah. Fortunately, we have pretty good treatments now, and I've seen an evolution in the treatment of croup. We used to put kids in the croup tents, and we don't do that anymore. Mm. But now, the most important thing to do if a child wakes up in the night and they're...
Oh, and it's terrifying.
They have that sealy bark.
Yes. Ugh.
Take the child out of the crib or out of his bed, either if it's a cold night, run him outside in your pajamas and freeze him and get him in the cold or put his head in the refrigerator. Cold air.
Wait a minute.
I know. It's a great picture, isn't it? But it's important. Just run outside for 10 minutes or so, and that sudden cold air on his vocal cords, which need to be shrunk, will help. Also, steam will help. One extreme or the other. For steam, just turn the shower on with the water as hot as you can get it. Get the bathroom as steamy as you can and let him breathe in that steamy air. If that doesn't help right away, take him to the emergency room, and the doctors can admit him if he's really severe.
What do they do there?
Well, if a child is really severe, you can put a breathing tube in them for a while. But usually we don't have to do that. Usually we can start them on steroids. And steroids, though they sound very scary, they help shrink the swelling of the tissues around the vocal cords to open up that airway.
What about a vaporizer or a humidifier?
That can help, but it doesn't help as much as a steamy shower or that cold air.
What are the symptoms of meningitis?
Again, that's every physician's nightmare. There are two types of, in general, of meningitis. There's viral meningitis, often called aseptic, and there's bacterial meningitis. Bacterial meningitis behaves differently than viral meningitis, but is more rare. Bacterial meningitis is an infection where different types of bacteria come and infect the spinal fluid that bathes the spinal cord in the brain. And that means if there's an infection in those areas, you could have a stiff neck, your back could hurt, the child could just feel achy all over. Now, children with any kind of virus are going to feel achy all over, so I don't want to alarm parents unduly. But a child with meningitis will typically, if you ask them to take their chin and put it on their chest, bend their head, flex it forward, a child won't do that because his neck hurts so much, and that's a sign of meningitis.
Oh.
Altered mental status is a sign of meningitis. Can be very tricky for a physician to pick up on, but it's very important if you feel your child is getting sick very fast and you don't know why, get him to an emergency room quickly. Mm-hmm. Bacterial meningitis acts very quickly and it can move within hours. Again, it's very rare. Viral meningitis, on the other hand, can come on more slowly. The symptoms are not as severe, but they're the same. You get a stiff neck. You get a headache that won't go away. The child has a fever that won't break. They don't want to get out of bed, and they just feel crummy all the time. And it's very important to take them to the doctor if you suspect that as well.
Now, meningitis can be related to encephalitis as well.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And that may be even more serious.
Encephalitis is infection of the brain tissue. Meningitis is infection of the fluids surrounding the brain, but encephalitis is actual infection of the brain tissue. And that, of course, is life-threatening. Both are life-threatening. And fortunately, both are pretty rare. But again, I encourage parents, use your gut. Look at your child. Look at your child. A mother or a father can look at their child's face and stare at him for 5 seconds and know if he's very sick, medium sick, or not too bad. Another test you can use is to give the child some Tylenol, and if the fever comes down within 40 minutes and now he perks up and he's acting pretty good, he doesn't have meningitis or anything really badly, because meningitis marches on. Encephalitis does too. Tylenol doesn't touch meningitis. So if you have a fever that responds to Tylenol or Advil, you're probably in pretty good shape. But nothing replaces intuition of a parent who's attentive to their child. And let me tell you something, moms and dads out there. I learned long ago from a very wise pediatrician, and he said to me this: if a mother comes in and tells you something's wrong with a child,
pay attention.
Don't let the child out of the room without figuring out what's wrong. Because if mom says something wrong, something's wrong. And so if you have a pediatrician that pats you on the shoulder and said, oh, you know, he'll be okay, I don't know what's wrong, but he's okay, you stay there and say, okay, would you bring your partner in here, please?
Wow.
And a good pediatrician will say, sure, I'm going to get a second opinion. Mm-hmm. I frequently, if I see a rash and I don't know what it is, I go grab one of my colleagues and say, hey, take a look at this rash. What do you think it is? Right in front of mom, and we'll say, okay, we think it's this. And so that's a sign of a good physician, is one who's going to really listen to you. So if your doctor doesn't listen, find another.
How concerned are you now with the bacterias that seem to be resistant to all known antibiotics? How often do you see those situations, such as MRSA and the others?
Well, bacteria that are resistant to antibiotics are a real challenge and concern for all physicians out there. And I have seen bacteria develop resistance over my short 30-year career in medicine, and they can be harder to treat. MRSA is the methicillin-resistant staph infection. Fortunately, most people who have MRSA and who are severely ill are in the hospital. I have taken care of a few children outpatient who have had MRSA, and it can be pretty tricky to get under control. But it is a real concern, and that's why we advocate to not overuse antibiotics. Many parents will come in with a child with a cold and say to me, I want to get on antibiotics because I want to get a jump on it. But antibiotics will not kill a virus, and a virus causes the common cold. Antibiotics will kill a bacterial infection in the ear, for instance. They will kill a strep throat, and they will kill other infections. But we have to use antibiotics very judiciously, because if we overuse them, the bacteria really outsmart us, and they've learned how to get around the antibiotics. And again, not to harp on the same thing, but I see sexually transmitted infections that are harder to treat now because they are resistant to the antibiotics we're giving them. In the 1980s and the early 1990s, we could treat gonorrhea, for instance, with simple antibiotics, and now they take some pretty high-powered antibiotics to kill them.
Don't you wish all physicians were as judicious as you just described?
Well,
aren't many doctors giving the antibiotics because a mother asked for them?
Yes, and I think good physicians know better. But a lot of physicians are people pleasers, and we want to fix. We went into medicine because we want to fix. We want to give mothers mm-hmm. something to do to help their children. And it's so easy to write a prescription and say, here, go home and give them this. And what we forget is sometimes just telling them what to give and giving them a list of things to do helps sometimes as much as antibiotics. And so when I have a child who has a situation, an illness that can't be cured with antibiotics, I always give mom a list of things to do so that she can feel that she's really attending to her child, helping him heal. But I don't fault physicians, because that's what we're trained to do, is to do something to help our patients.
Dr. Meeker, it's my understanding that more children die of accidents than any other thing, including various diseases and disabilities. Talk about that, and how can parents be more vigilant to protect their kids?
Well, again, the number one cause of death in young children is accidents, and most accidents happen at home while mom is there, or dad, whoever's the primary caregiver. And that's pretty unsettling, but we can see why that happens, because we're trying to multitask, and we've got a toddler running around, and we're on the phone, and we're paying our bills or doing whatever we're doing.
So you got to watch them every second.
I tell mothers of two-year-olds in my practice, here's the deal. Your job every day when you have a two-year-old is to make sure your child's alive by the time he goes to bed. And if he's alive, you've mm-hmm. won. That's all you need to do, is make sure he stays alive.
You understand that, don't you, Dad?
Very well.
We get so worried about other things, but that's our job, and to realize that period of intense activity does go away. One thing I like to tell parents is to make sure that their house is childproof. I encourage them to get down on their knees and crawl around and see the home through a child's eyes. And basically, a child is looking for any creative way he can to harm himself or kill himself with an electrical outlet or a telephone cord. I guess we don't have telephone cords anymore, but drapery cords. And to make sure the cords are tied up, or any kind of lamp cord is out of a child's way. The other thing that's important is choking, and parents forget about that as well. Another important thing to do is have Ipecac in the house, and mm-hmm. it's an old medication we don't think about. Ipecac, you can buy at any grocery store, pharmacy, and it induces vomiting. And it's important to have on a shelf high up in your kitchen, because ingestions usually happen in the kitchen. Because kids are, you know, crawling around underneath the sink or kitchen cupboards where you keep your household cleaning supplies. And it's important that if your child ingests something, before you give the Ipecac, call poison control. So in addition to having Ipecac in the kitchen high on a shelf, have a poison control number posted somewhere in your kitchen, so that if your child ingests something, that's something that you want to immediately act on before you even call your doctor. Mm-hmm. Call poison control. Say, my child ingested this. I don't know how much. Should I induce vomiting or not? And finally, the other thing that parents need to act on quickly before they go to a doctor would be if a child gets something in his eye. The skin in the eye is so sensitive and so quickly damaged that if a child gets something in his eye or burned, put the child upside down in the sink, take a sprayer if you can, open the eye, and wash the eye out as rapidly as you can. Mm-hmm. And those are really important tips that parents need to act on quickly before they need to go to a doctor.
Dr. Meeker, I was a hazardous child, can I say, Dad?
To you and everybody else.
Yeah. One thing that I worry about with my kids is concussion, falling and hitting their heads. I heard a doctor give a reference for if it's under a 4-foot fall, you're probably okay. I don't remember what that was. How susceptible are children to concussions?
Well, I don't like the words probably when it comes to my patients, because my job as a pediatrician isn't to make sure that most of the kids in my practice are okay or that they're probably going to be okay. I like to make sure that all of them are okay. In fact, a child can do severe damage by falling off of a coffee table, and they can fall out a second-story window and be fine. So we don't, and I've seen both of those scenarios. Yeah. Fortunately for us, in young children, before the skull actually closes, and it's like a jigsaw puzzle, the skull, and it actually has things called sutures, which are lines in between the different bones of the skull. And before those close, there's a lot of flexibility in the skull. Also, you've got the cerebrospinal fluid and that bathes the brain, that kind of protects the brain. So I've seen some kids take some pretty bad spills, and they've come out pretty well. What I do get concerned about is kids in sports, and I see a lot of accidents in hockey, concussions in hockey and in football, kids who are even wearing helmets. Mm-hmm. So I tend to worry about the older kids more than the younger kids, because young children, healthy young children, particularly boys, are running around, they're getting into trouble, they're falling out of trees, sometimes they're breaking bones, but most of them do pretty well. If your child does fall and you're worried about a concussion, the first 24 hours of observation are the most important. Mm-hmm. Contrary to popular belief, you don't need to waken your child in the night. Sleep is protective for the brain, and studies have shown that you really can allow the child to fall asleep. What you want to pay attention to is, again, it's the gut of the parent. If you look at the child, is he acting normal? Is he talking normally? Does he seem like your child, or does he seem like a different child? Mm. If you sense any kind of subtle change, right to the doctor.
Eyes focusing, nausea and vomiting.
Nausea and vomiting, like exactly, mm-hmm. exactly. If your child vomits once, okay, but if he vomits twice, he's bought himself a ticket to the doctor's. Mm.
Mm. You mentioned sports, and I saw a study recently among soccer players that were getting low-grade concussions repeatedly from heading the ball in soccer, and they're not quite sure what to do about it because mm-hmm. these are high school kids are serious athletes now,
yes.
and you got to worry about those concussions.
Well, I jokingly tell the male soccer athletes in my practice that I really want them to wear a helmet. And they look at me and laugh and say, aren't you crazy? But I wish that we could have some type of head protective gear for soccer players because they have some very serious head injuries. I see it more and more in the professional hockey players and boxers, of course, and maybe even soccer players because the level of play is so much more intense and aggressive mm-hmm. now, and they're going to have a lot more head injuries. So, you know, I don't care if soccer helmets look geeky. I wish that somebody would come up with one.
It's good advice.
Well, Doctor, I got to admit, it does feel like I've had a private office visit here with my favorite pediatrician, and I didn't even have to wait in a waiting room. So I hope all the listeners have appreciated this.
Well, when we started the program last time, we said we're going to imagine ourselves in the examining room where Dr. Meeker is going to address some of the common problems of childhood and some of the diseases and some of the other things parents should know. I think this has been a good primer. Should have been about 15 programs long, but yeah. We'll see if we can get that done in the future. Dr. Meeker, thank you for being with us, and we just really enjoy working with you.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a pure delight.
Well, and I think we all share that sentiment. Ryan, as much fun as we've had together, I'm also confident that these programs have provided some very practical help for parents listening.
Well, that's one of the reasons we're here, to put tools in the hands of parents, because it's a tough world and we can all use all the help we can get.
Well, then let me drive you to more resources that we have available for you at drjamesdobson.org, specifically for you moms and dads who need more information like we've heard today, such as Dr. Dobson's classic parenting books.
That's right. We have those and links to Dr. Meeker's books all at drjamesdobson.org.
And as you've probably noticed, we've been hearing from Dr. Meeker quite a bit these days at Family Talk, discussing topics like postpartum depression and ADHD. Mm-hmm. You can find all of these discussions online at drjamesdobson.org or give us a call, 877-732-6825.
And just a quick reminder, we are listener supported and we could use your financial support as we continue our mission of helping families. Donate online at drjamesdobson.org, via our Family Talk app, or even on our Facebook page.
Or by phone, that number one last time, 877-732-6825. Thanks so much for spending this part of your day with us, and we do invite you back next time for another edition of Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk.
We'll see you then.
Family Talk is not affiliated with Focus on the Family.